papermen meet such interesting people. They know the lowdown, now it can be told. I'll tell you quite reliably off the record about some charming people I have known. For I meet politicians and grafters by the score, killers plain and fancy, it's really quite a bore. Oh, newspapermen meet such interesting people. They wallow in corruption, crime and gore. Ting-a-ling-ling, city desk, pull the press, extra, extra, read all about it, it's a mess, meets the test. Oh, newspapermen meet such interesting people. It's wonderful to represent the press.
Now, the Media Project is a half hour of commentary and analysis with some veteran newsroom leaders so that you can get some insight into some of the ethical decision making that goes on behind the scenes in media outlets. I'm Rex Smith of the Upstate American, formerly editor of the Times Union and the Record of Troy, here with a couple of my colleagues, Judy Patrick, formerly editor of the Daily Gazette in Schenectady and formerly vice president of the New York Press Association, and Barbara Lombardo, the former executive editor of the Saratogian and the Troy Record. What's on your mind today, Judy? What are you going to look at?
You know, I'd like to talk about the struggle small local papers have in hiring reporters. There seems to be fewer reporters out there, and there's a new muckrack survey out there that seems to validate what I've known for 5 or 10 years now.
That the local journalism scene is not healthy, let's say.
Well, you're suggesting, Judy, that it's not only that they don't want to hire because they can't afford to do so, but that they can't find the journalists to do it. So that'll be an interesting thing to talk about today.
Yeah, agreed. Absolutely. And as we go into this, one of the things that I'm interested in talking about is this. I think we would all agree that a public official has an obligation to be accessible to the people he or she serves. And that accessibility, we would say, coming out of newsrooms, ought to extend to mass media. And by the way, for all of his other faults, we probably ought to note that Donald Trump is the most accessible president probably since Teddy Roosevelt. Granted, he's just as likely to lie to you as tell you the truth, but he's there, right? Anyway, so that's why it's worth discussing that the guy who is now the top federal law enforcement official in the 32 counties of northern New York, interim United States Attorney John Sarcone III, whose appointment, by the way, was controversial from the get-go. He had never worked as a prosecutor before he assumed office. He was an election lawyer for Donald Trump, counsel for some labor unions. And then two things happened. First, outside the Albany Hilton downtown a few weeks ago, he had an encounter with a knife-wielding man from El Salvador in the country illegally. And there are some questionable details. You know, Sarcone said that the guy lunged at him. The video doesn't show that at all. But in any case, the guy pleaded guilty to menacing after the charge was knocked down from attempted murder. It's a misdemeanor. He's going to be deported. But then Brendan Lyons, a Times Union managing editor, revealed that the address that Sarcone had listed as his residence on the sworn forms, incidentally, submitted for the Salvadoran guy's arrest, that address is a derelict building in Albany's Sheridan Hollow. It's abandoned. It's now unlivable based upon all of Brendan's reporting. And again, Sarcone seems to not have been fully forthright in describing where he lives and the work being done in the place and such. The residence question matters because the law requires the U.S. attorney to live in the district that he or she serves, and Sarcone's home is down in Westchester County, not part of the Northern District. So what does this have to do with the media, other than the great reporting by Brendan Lyons, who, for my book, is the best investigative reporter of his generation in this community? That all, anyway, was reported straight, with Sarcone and his landlord quoted. And he wouldn't like it because the story pointed to anomalies in the prosecutor's descriptions, contradictions, but it was straightforward watchdog reporting. But now Sarcone, seemingly in retribution, has directed his office staff to remove the Times Union and all of its staff members from media distribution lists, meaning that when federal prosecutors do something newsworthy in the northern region of New York, they will be intentionally trying to block the news from getting to the largest newsroom in the region, which sounds a lot like Donald Trump blocking the Associated Press from fully covering his White House. So here's the question that I think we ought to talk about. There's no legal obligation for any public official to notify the media about anything or to talk to any journalist. But A, what should reporters do? What should news leaders do when a newsroom is blocked like this? How do you even cover the news? And once you've noted that somebody you're covering is, you know, kind of loose with the facts, how do you build a relationship so that you can fairly cover what they're doing? I mean, this guy has created a problem, don't you think?
A problem for all the media in the area. And Casey Seiler, the editor over there, has got some work to do as well. I mean, what do you do? In some respects, you know, take me off the mailing list, so big deal. You never send me anything interesting in a press release anyway. I can get it some other way. But I think it's symbolic as well. Are they going to make every aspect of reporting difficult for the Times Union going forward? This is clear retribution. But it may not be a legal requirement, but it's a moral requirement, because a reporter, and in this case a very large media company in this area, they represent the people, so they're essentially denying the people access to this information. So what do? You make the calls. I mean, in this case, you can't really go higher than this guy because it seems like the whole system is rigged against you, but you can make calls to the senators, but you have to keep plugging away. There are plenty of stories for Brendan left to do, and for the regular reporters who cover the courts or the system. Can I just make the point that the Northern District is a pretty big district to find a place to live?
From the Canadian border out to Syracuse and south to near Westchester, to near where he was.
Yeah, mm-hmm. And I would add to that that this was an incidental discovery. So it's not as though the Times Union was going after this guy. I can understand where if I had been attacked by a knife-wielding person and then the story that became news was being turned against me because of a discovery that was made, I'd be going, hey, how about that knife attack?
Yeah.
What are you doing here? But incidental discoveries happen in journalism, and this was worth reporting. So it doesn't take away the legitimacy or of what might have happened to him on the street. But when you are claiming to be living somewhere and you're obviously not, you're lying. You're in a position where you shouldn't be lying to the public about anything. And how do you know what else to trust? You can't trust anything. So this is a legitimate story. The problem now, when you see CNN cut off on the federal level, or AP cut off on the federal level, when you see this at the local level, how are you supposed to tell stories? It's a huge challenge. A reporter like Brendan could probably have a sideline of training reporters how to cover beats and how to get stories from the non-official channels.
He does that, by the way. That is why he's named managing editor of the Times Union. He trains.
I meant as a, it could be a national project.
Oh, yes, he could.
I think it was Casey who tweeted or posted something on Blue Sky referenced the Barbara Streisand
effect. About to read it. Casey wrote on Blue Sky, the social media platform, "This story demonstrates two things at minimum. That Sarcone thinks real journalists are dependent on news releases to do their work, and that he's never heard of the Streisand effect." Now, if you don't know what the Streisand effect is, Barbara Streisand got all upset that Google Maps or something, had taken a picture of her mansion on a cliff overhanging, or maybe it was a story about coastal erosion, and it showed her mansion, and she got all upset that this photograph showed her home. Nobody had noticed it. Nobody knew this is her home. And so suddenly she's getting all upset about something, drawing attention to it. And I do think that if Mr. Sarcone had just said, well, yeah, you're right, the house didn't get fixed yet, I'm not quite there, I'm staying at the hotel, which is why I was downtown waiting for this guy to knife me. He might have also tried to tell the truth about what happened outside the hotel. But in any case, he could have not tried to distort matters from the get-go, which just drew more attention to it.
Well, he put his fake address in the affidavit when this was reported to the sheriffs.
Yeah.
So that's how that started.
The retribution just seems petty, but it's not something we haven't encountered before. I mean, we've had instances where you will have a mayor or a district attorney call up the editor and say, I'm not going to talk to this particular reporter going forward. Or I can remember cases out in Utica where the reporter was banned from going to City Hall. And so what do the editors do in that position? Typically, the editors, when they get those calls from the mayor and the district attorney, say, you can't pick and choose what reporter is going to cover you. I mean, back in the day when we ran ships, people were more reasonable. I don't know what you do when you have such a level of unreasonableness in the operation of an important agency like the U.S. Attorney's Office.
It just makes it more important for reporters to develop independent sources. What it does, actually, is it creates a pathway. Sometimes if you're in the woods and there suddenly is a beaver dam in the way of your trail, you make your way around the beaver dam.
I hate when that happens. And
I'm just remembering walking through the woods. And so you end up creating a new trail. trail for yourself.
It's long, a little bit longer, a little more difficult.
But you get there. And you get the analogy, this is pretty good. That basically, reporters now are going to be developing sources independent of the U.S. attorney that might not have been there otherwise.
But you also have to hope that there are people in those jobs that you're referring to that are willing to talk because they can get into trouble if they're found out, or they might be of a like mind with the person who's banning you. So it does become more difficult, and the public doesn't know what they aren't learning about by being shut off, or they say, oh, that loser publication, they can't even get a story for me. It's challenging.
I'm also hopeful. I know that this is something that wouldn't have happened before, but somebody else on that list, some other newspaper, some other radio station, some other news organization forwards all the emails they get from the attorney's office over to Brendan, so he stays in the loop.
One of the interesting dynamics of reporters not getting folks handing them stuff that we've all observed in our newsrooms is that it does force you to be more enterprising. I remember a wonderful reporter named Allison Mitchell, who was my predecessor as Albany Bureau Chief at Newsday when I came up here, became a Washington correspondent, eventually became national editor of the New York Times. And she was telling me what a great thing it was to work in the Albany Bureau of Newsday because politicians would talk to you because it was a big enough outlet. But she said in the Washington Bureau for Newsday, she was nothing because Newsday was not a big player nationally. But she said, if I'm trying to get something from the Pentagon and you're calling an assistant secretary of defense, the guy comes back to his desk after lunch, and it was always a he in those days. And in those days, she said, and he has all these pink slips. Remember those when you were out slips? He has all these pink slips sitting there saying, I got a call from CBS News. Right,
those
call
are not,
from
the those
New
are
York
not
Times.
Getting fired slips.
Not that kind
Even
of pink
Even the newer
slips.
People don't know that either.
Yeah, right. While you were out, you got CBS News and the New York Times, and you've got the Wall Street Journal, and here's Allison Mitchell of Newsday. And she said, they're not going to call me back because they're calling people who are more important than I am. But that means that I don't start there. I start with the lower level people and I develop sources there. And that's really an interesting element of reporting. Oftentimes, you will find capable reporters at less powerful news organizations develop skills and create sources just because they have to.
And I've also seen what Judy was alluding to, I believe, of some collegiality among reporters where you know that you are competing to get the stories. So you want to beat them on the story or get a better story if there is actually competition where you are. And in this area, there is competition. But you are also in a position where it behooves you to be friendly to your competitors and to help one another. And when we get to the other discussion about local jobs at local newspapers, I did make a discovery. I was informed about how that is happening on a local level.
Well, let's get to that topic, since that's a great topic. You're listening, if you just tuned in, to the Media Project from Northeast Public Radio. Judy Patrick and Barbara Lombardo are here. I'm Rex Smith. So there is this new report, the Local Journalist Index study by Muckrack, which is a platform for journalists and folks in PR, and Rebuild Local News, which is a nonpartisan, not-for-profit that's trying to strengthen community news. They have found in 2002, the U.S. had about 40 journalists per 100,000 residents. Today, about 8.2 local journalists for 100,000 residents. That's a drop of journalists of 75%. High population, low coverage. There are some big counties that actually are not well off. Queens, New York, the local county that is Los Angeles, they actually have lower numbers because a lot of them are in the suburbs, I guess. And some fast-growing suburbs are underserved. Anyway, more than a third of the counties in the U.S., home to 20.6 million Americans, have less than one local journalist per 100,000 residents. So what do we make of this?
You know, sometimes these reports or these surveys are not entirely accurate or tend to overstate the concern. But I can tell you from someone who dealt with small newspapers, finding reporters and editors is incredibly, incredibly difficult. I remember 20 years ago when I was looking for a reporter, I would get probably 20, 25 resumes. I'm hearing from editors now, they're lucky they get one or two. Part of the problem is the fact that we don't pay very much, small local papers especially, and you're getting kids out of school with these huge amounts of student debt that they can't afford to work in a small newspaper. A lot of them want to go to the city and make a big name for themselves in some magazine. magazine or some television show. It is a real problem. The number of people out in the field looking for jobs is so small. I know editors that spend a lot of time recruiting, just trying to convince people to come to their shops. So it's a problem. Part of the problem is we keep talking about the fact that we're a dying industry. And who wants to go work in a dying industry? We need to stop that.
That's right. We forget to mention that we're also hated and not trusted.
Yeah. And so that's one of the reasons I like to, when I am out and about talking to young people who are interested in journalism career, talk about what an interesting, noble career it is. But this is a trend that seems to be only getting worse.
I'm about 15 years into teaching one class a semester in journalism at University at Albany, and I try to hit home with the students that if you want a job in journalism, you have to do something besides show up in class or even do well in class. You have to demonstrate your hunger for the business. No worries. Most of them are not interested in going into journalism for the reasons you're citing. But at the same time, I'll give you an example of a former editor of the Albany Student Press, the school newspaper at UAlbany, has started a job full-time going direct to Syracuse.com.
Excellent.
So in the old days, not too long ago, if you were graduating, even as a editor of your paper, you would be happy to be getting a job at the Saratogian to start off. And in a couple of years, you might be able to get to the Gazette or the Times Union if you really could show your stuff. Now you're going directly to Syracuse.
It's quite a change. One of the interesting things that I just heard a few weeks ago at a graduation ceremony, the speaker was Brian Lehrer, who is the morning host of a talk show, a call-in show in WNYC in New York City. And Brian Lehrer was exhorting these young journalism graduates, fall in love with local news, he said. This is really where the crux of the job is going to be. And I actually believe we're going to see a return to that. I think we're going to see more young journalists coming back and recognizing that there is great work to be done locally. One of the ways that that's going to happen, I think, is responding to one of the concerns that you raised, Judy, since we don't pay very much. And since students tend to have debt, you know, there are now a lot of work to repay efforts underway. Reporters for America, for example, has funding from foundations, and these young people can, in effect, work off their student loans as well as make some additional money by having their salaries bolstered by philanthropy.
I'm also seeing ways to sweeten the pot for students. There's something, I think it's called the Institute for Local News, and the current program director for the journalism program at UAlbany has established a really nice relationship with that organization. And we have students who, through the classes, are working with, it's a type of an internship, you might say, with the Spotlight, for instance, and trying to do the same with other media in the area. So the students I found were very excited and enthused about getting their material published and being able to do a little digging and tell stories. So that has helped win a couple of people over in the student body.
You know, there's actually never been a better time in the history of the world to get published and never a worse time to get paid for what you publish.
It's true. You know, I used to fight to try to get on A1, and now there's less of competition for that. You know, I was talking to a group of young journalists. They'd been in the business 2 or 3 years, and I asked them, you know, what can the industry do for you? You know, I was thinking maybe, you know, they want some sophisticated investigative tools, or, you know, I was looking for that. And the first thing I got, what they wanted, health insurance. They wanted some health insurance. And then the second thing that they were asking for, that they said they weren't getting on the job, was mentorship from the editors. That their editors that are left there are so strapped, they're so busy, they don't have time to work with them to have their stories be improved, to have their investigations go in different places, to add layers to their experience. And they were looking for that, and the industry wasn't giving that to them because we're putting so much pressure on our editors to do other things. Mm-hmm. So we're not giving them the career guidance that they're looking for, and we're not getting basics. Like, I mean, when I started, I got medical insurance and a pension.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it's a wonderful thing.
Well, you must be living large. I agree with the things that you're saying, and I have seen from personal experience that as the Saratogian has reduced staff, and the person who's the top editor there now, with one editor below him, is in charge of two newspapers, as I was, but he has fewer people, and he has no physical location. not in Troy and not in Saratoga. So the reporters have no place to gather. You're not getting that camaraderie and
yes.
the mentorship by having somebody looking over your shoulder and talking to you directly. It's a different type of learning experience, and I don't think it doesn't sound as much fun to me. The reporters I'm seeing are sometimes getting around this by making their own little mini groups. I was talking to a bureau chief of WAMC a couple of weeks ago, and I was lamenting how there's a very new, she seems very capable reporter at the Saratogian, but who does she get to talk to and beef to and learn mm-hmm. from? And he informed me that the two of them and a couple other journalists are on their little text message group. So
excellent.
I mean, they're learning as they go. And you have somebody to turn to.
Yeah, as we think back about our own careers, that fellowship, for lack of a better word, that sort of camaraderie, the experience of being with your colleagues was both educational and joyful. One of the reasons why reporters love still being a part of the New York State Capitol Press Corps, where Barbara, your son, works, for example, is because there is that camaraderie. There's a great community of a couple dozen journalists there on the second floor of the state capitol, a third floor of the state capitol. They would like to be on the second, but the governor obstructs it. I think it's a great idea to have, perhaps even at the risk of competition, if there could be a meeting, a central point where the journalists can gather for their various publications. That would make some sense.
Well, there have been things, and I don't know if they still exist. In New York State, the Associated Press for many years had these really nice sessions where you would get together and you would learn things. They tied it with their award sessions, but they were learning opportunities, and that went away. And then I thought the New York Press Association had done a wonderful job for years having a session every year so that journalists could get together.
Yeah, that still happens once a year or twice a year. And it's interesting to see all the reporters come together and interact, especially when we have roundtable sessions. I deal with editors and they, from all over areas of the state, you hear there's different concerns. But we've identified the problem, industry. Now you go fix it.
So before we leave today, we need to talk about what went on in Texas. The terrible flooding along the Guadalupe River that has caused more than 100 deaths. And the journalism about this, I think there are two issues that are interesting. There are a number, but journalistically, one, there was a lot of false news reporting, some videos that were viral videos that seemingly were fake. And second, the issue of how journalists now respond to the issues that are raised about the government not putting in place the appropriate warnings, about the cutbacks to climate change research and funding to retard climate change, when we know that this kind of disaster is only going to get worse as a result of climate change. This is really fertile ground for great journalism at this point.
Oh, indeed. In fact, first, can I point out that these contentious press conferences are worthless. If you're going to have a press conference, at least answer the questions. I was dismayed at the fact that the officials in charge were not answering simple questions like who knew what, when. I mean, and laying it on the reporters for how dare you ask for these questions.
Yeah, the questions were even simpler than that because the reporters were trying to understand the process. So while the person at the podium maybe wasn't ready to point a finger, to at least answer the question about what's the process for who's responsible for doing what, when. And you're right, Judy, they wouldn't even answer that.
Right. This is a trend in press conferences where they feel a need to have a press conference. They want to get on CNN. I'm not even sure why they even bother if they're not going to answer, again, simple questions. But going forward, there does need to be far greater scrutiny about what happened in Texas, but how it relates to what else is happening in the country. And, polling shows that most Americans still do not think climate change will affect them because they think these things have been happening forever. So this is not unusual. I think the press coverage in Texas, the fact that things started to happen on a weekend means that things got off to something of a slow start. I think it's picked up as the days have gone by. And I think there's been some really solid reporting out of even the Texas Tribune has done some heroic work. I'm into accountability. You need to tell the stories of all the people that have died. At this point, one of the reasons I think that they're saying that a certain number of people are still missing and a certain number of people are confirmed dead, I think that keeps the ultimate number low, which makes it seem like it's less of a disaster than it is. I mean, let's be honest, more than 300 people have died in this.
Mm-hmm. And it's not always simple and black and white. We're not going to be able to say this happened because that guy resigned because he knew his job was going to be lost and they didn't fill it. It's not going to be just because of climate change. It's not going to be just because of the federal cutbacks. It's not going to be just because they failed to proceed with the sirens that they talked about. There's a combination, and the reporters need to stay on top of this.
It is, as often, the job of the journalist to connect the dots for people and to give them the coverage that will give them a sense of why things happen. That's kind of the task. And that's where we have to end it for today. The Media Project, once again, has brought you some insight, we hope, into what's going on in the news media. Barbara Lombardo, Judy Patrick here. I'm Rex Smith. Thanks to our producer, Dave Gustina. And we hope you folks will join us again next week for The Media Project.
Such interesting people. It must have startled poor old Sadie's aunt. Ting-a-ling-a-ling, city desk. Hold the press, extra, extra, read all about it. It's a mess, meets the test. Oh, newspapermen meet such interesting people. Like the richest girl who could not bake a cake. Ting-a-ling, ting-a-ling, ling-a-ling-a-ling. Now, newspapermen are such interesting people. They used to work like hell just for romance. But finally, the movies notwithstanding, they all got tired of patches on their pants.
The Media Project is a national production of WAMC, Northeast Public Radio. This week's projectors include former Times Union editor and current Upstate American Substack columnist Rex Smith, Judy Patrick, vice president for editorial development for the New York Press Association and former editor of the Daily Gazette, and Barbara Lombardo, adjunct professor at the University at Albany and former editor of the Saratogian. You can listen to The Media Project anytime at WAMCpodcast.org or anywhere you get your podcasts. I'm your producer, David Gustina. Thanks for listening.
Their policy is an acrobatic thing. They claim to represent the common people. Funny, Wall Street never has complained. Ah, but publishers have worries, for publishers must go to working folks for readers and to big shots for their dough. Now, publishers are such interesting people. It could be prostitution, I don't know. Ting-a-ling-a-ling, circulation, ting-a-ling-a-ling, advertising, get those readers, get that payoff. What a headache, what a mess. Oh, publishers are such interesting people. Let's give free cheers for freedom of the press.